You were appointed on this case. You have the thanks of the court for your service to your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement. And our last case of the morning is 093879, United States versus Tavares. Mr. Donahue.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Michael Donahoe. I'm with the Indiana Federal Community Defender in Indianapolis, and here on behalf of Lorenzo Tavares today. Mr. Tavares was convicted of two counts of distribution of methamphetamine in excess of 50 grams. He challenges those convictions on two grounds. The first is sufficiency of the evidence, and the second is the failure of the district court to issue a missing witness instruction. The two counts of conviction stem from two different events that occurred on two different days, separated by 6 days. The first, count one, was based on event of June 12th, 2008, and the government had utilized the services of a confidential informant who went to Mr. Tavares' residence and was frisked and searched prior to entering that residence to verify that there were no controlled substances. The confidential informant entered the residence, came out a while later, left, joined back up with law enforcement, made a telephone or received a telephone call, then went back to the residence, came back out that time in possession of about 79 grams of methamphetamine and provided that to law enforcement. That is the sum and substance of the proof that supports the conviction on count one. There is no evidence as to who was in the apartment, what role, if any, Mr. Tavares had in distribution of the meth that was given to the confidential informant. How many people were in there, what conversations took place, nothing at all like that. And the problem that has been created in this case is because the government elected to proceed to trial against Mr. Tavares without using the confidential informant as a witness. So all they have on count one is that the informant went into an apartment that he resided in and got some methamphetamine in there.
She had apparently disappeared. Nobody could find her, right?
I believe that is the case, yes. Yes. And, of course, we hear over and over again that mere presence at the scene of a crime or during the commission of a crime is not evidence of guilt. But as to count one, the government didn't even establish the defendant's presence. Now, the next event on June 18th is similar, but there's a little bit more evidence to talk about. On June 18th, the informant again was searched. No controlled substances went into the residence. At that time, Mr. Tavares was present. It's uncontested that he was there. Surveillance established that, and he did not contest that at trial. It's not in the record, though, as to how many other people were or were not in the apartment. Obviously, confidential informant was the only person that went in there. There isn't anything in the record as to how many bedrooms are in that apartment, how many people lived there, how many people were there on that June 18th date.
Don't we know there were at least two who lived there, Mr. Donahoe?
We know there were at least two.
Okay.
That's true.
We
Mr.
don't
Tavares
know.
And his girlfriend, but beyond that, in terms of the size of the apartment, the investigating officers did refer to a master bedroom, which suggests more than one bedroom, but there isn't anything in the record as to whether a 2, 3, 4 bedroom apartment or how many other people may have lived there besides Tavares and his girlfriend. But on June 18th, then, the informant comes out. This time has about 76 grams of methamphetamine. It is packaged in a clear plastic bag, and that bag then is concealed inside a Dorito chip bag and rolled into a cylinder or a tube.
Didn't that bag contain the fingerprint of your client?
It did. Yeah, that was printed later, and the Dorito bag had a fingerprint of Mr. Tavares on there. And, of course, before We attach too much significance to that. We have to keep in mind that pretty much everything in that apartment probably had his and also his girlfriend's fingerprints on it, because that's where they lived. There is no testimony at all. There's nothing in the record about how the confidential informant came in possession of that Fritos bag, whether she took it, or Doritos bag, whether it came from the trash, whether it had been given to her, whether it had been discarded, nothing at all like that. There were no prints of Mr. Tavares found on the plastic bag that contained the meth that was inside the Doritos bag. That day, on June 18th, the CI had been provided with about $4,500 in Xerox and recorded buy money. And later, when Mr. Tavares was arrested on or about July 1st, he gave consent to search his apartment, and approximately $16,000 was found in the breast pocket of some male clothing, what appeared to be a men's sport coat, and about $4,200 of the pre-recorded buy money was found, although aside from the fact that the clothing was described as being male clothing, Mr. Tavares is a male who did live there. There was no other connection between him and the clothing, and as far as I know, the jacket was not introduced in evidence. There wasn't anything in the record about Mr. Tavares's build or size or the size of that coat. So on the June 18th, they've got presents. They've got a fingerprint on the bag that contained the bag that contained the meth, and they have buy money that showed up about 2 weeks later when he was finally arrested. It is our position that that type of evidence is wholly insufficient to allow any reasonable trier of fact to find beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Tavares was connected with the drug transaction. As far as the first transaction on June 12th, the evidence doesn't even show that he was there. As far as the second, it shows simply that he was there when it took place. At the close of the government's evidence, trial counsel did move for judgment of acquittal under Rule 29. That was denied, and then that was renewed again after the jury returned its verdict. Mr. Tavares' second point on appeal is that because the government did not produce the CI at trial, a missing witness instruction was requested and denied by the trial court.
How much did the defense know about the identity, description, et cetera, of the CI?
I believe they knew the CI was female, mm-hmm. and that her first name was Rosie, or she went by Rosie, and that is the extent of what defense counsel knew about the CI.
So Ms. Scott tried the case?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. In order to be entitled to the missing witness instruction, a defendant has to show that this particular witness has knowledge that would not just be cumulative of what someone else testified to, and also that the witness is peculiarly within the control of the opposing party. And the court found, as to the first point, that this witness did have knowledge of crucial facts that no one else could testify to, namely, what went on in the apartment, and what role, if any, did Mr. Tavares have? But the court denied the instruction because the second prong had not been established, which is that the witness was not necessarily within the control of the government. Now, this court has dealt with the issue of confidential informants before and whether or not they can be deemed to be within the control of the government, and as a general rule, that is not the case. But I think in a case like this, where you have as much contact as there was between this CI and law enforcement for weeks leading up to the defendant's arrest, providing transportation to and from her car, which was near the Tavares apartment, and providing her with funds and money, and meeting with her before and after all of this, I think it shows a certain degree of control that obviously the defendant doesn't enjoy. And it is certainly suspiciously convenient that when it comes time to allow a defendant to cross-examine someone that can make or break the case, all of a sudden the government can't find that person. That was the only person that could say what happened and what didn't happen. And the only person that could provide any sort of proof that any reasonable trier of fact could find beyond a reasonable doubt that he had committed these offenses. And I don't think that the government, without that witness, is able to make its case. So unless there are questions from the panel,
all right.
I'll the rest of my time. Thank you.
Mr. Glickman.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Barry Glickman. I'm an assistant United States attorney from Indianapolis, Indiana. I represent the United States here on appeal today, and I represented the United States in the trial court below. Let me clear up one thing and just respond very briefly to some of the arguments raised by Mr. Tavares' counsel this morning. This is not a case where the United States elected to proceed without the confidential informant. If I had the confidential informant, I'd probably be reading the defendant's Anders brief about now. But that was not the case, and from a very, very strong direct evidence case, I went from trying that to trying a very strong circumstantial case. And that's pretty much how the case went. Factually, Mr. Donahoe has adequately represented what occurred factually, but what the defense is stuck with in this case is that the defendant's fingerprint was on a Doritos bag, which contained a plastic bag containing methamphetamine from the second buy on June the 18th of 2008. And in what is indisputably the defendant's residence, I would also point out that he had the key that after he consented to the search of that law enforcement went into, there was $4,200. Over half of the $6,000 that was paid to him for the two purchases of methamphetamine throughout the course of this investigation in what is arguably or beyond argument his apartment. So I would respectfully suggest to the court that based on that, it is a strong circumstantial case. It was a strong circumstantial case. This court has said on numerous occasions that for a defendant to prevail on a sufficiency of the evidence argument, it is nearly an insurmountable hurdle, and I would respectfully suggest that they have not overcome that hurdle in this case, as there was evidence with which the jury could find that the defendant distributed methamphetamine on the two occasions charged in the indictment. With respect to the missing witness instruction, and again, I'll just reiterate again, this is not an instance where the government was hiding the confidential informant in any way, shape, or form. As the record shows, the defendant at the conclusion, actually at the start of the second day at the instructions conference, for the first time, moved for a missing witness instruction, and the court and myself had to deal with it at that time. But the defense knew.
I assume the defense was. No, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. No.
I thought you were about to tell me what the defense knew or expected about whether the CI was going to show up.
Well, they knew that the CI wasn't going to show up because I told the defendant that prior to trial, or Ms. Scott that prior to trial. Mm-hmm. She knew well in advance that the CI wasn't going to show up. I would also add that there was never a motion made by the defense to disclose the identity of the confidential informant. Not that they have to do that to get the missing witness instruction, but they well knew who the confidential informant was. The confidential informant was a friend of the defendant's girlfriend who they claim lived with the defendant at that time. So they knew who the confidential informant was. But be that as it may, this court has always said that it has disfavored giving that instruction for a variety of reasons. But the reason that Judge Lawrence found that it wasn't appropriate is because the informant in this case was equally unavailable to the government as well as the defense. And that situation was covered in the Keplinger case, where this court said where a witness appears to be equally available or unavailable to both sides, this court has said that it is well within the district court's discretion to refuse to allow argument about a missing witness. And my contention on this point is bolstered by U.S. against Rollins. In that case, this court has said that a witness's status as a government informant didn't necessarily establish that she's available to testify only on behalf of the prosecution. This is a case where I would have loved to have had the confidential informant, but the confidential informant just wasn't available in the time leading up to the trial in this case. Judge Lawrence was absolutely correct in not giving the missing witness instruction because the informant was unavailable to both sides, and I would respectfully ask this court to affirm the judgments of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glickman. Mr. Donahoe, anything further? I think your time had expired, but if you have a very quick rebuttal, go ahead.
I can do it in under a minute. In order to convict, the jury had to speculate. They had to speculate that the print on the Dorito bag was there for an illegal or nefarious purpose rather than just because he lived there and he might have used that product. They have to speculate entirely that he was there on June 12th when there is absolutely no evidence, either direct or circumstantial. They have to speculate that he got the $6,000 that counsel for the government just said when it was paid to him. There was no evidence that it was ever paid to him at all, just evidence that it went into the apartment and didn't come out. They have to speculate that the coat that was found in there belonged to him. And I think that's just too much speculation to allow a guilty verdict to stand. Thank you.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. And Mr. Donahoe, you were appointed to represent your client in this case.
Yes,
you have the thanks of the court. That concludes the call of the day. The court will stand in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
It's almost 1 o'clock.